Good evening, everybody. There is a beautiful rumour doing the rounds that I was just four in 1994. And ceasefires were announced. There's also another more hideous rumour that I was actually working for UTV reporting when the ceasefires were announced. Neither are true. Somewhere in between, and I'll maybe reveal that as the night goes on. In a few moments, we're going to kick off the panel discussion. I'm going to do my best to try and control some of these people. You can take your pick as to who's going to be the hardest, possibly to my left here. But before that, Jim had just suggested that I maybe share a few thoughts as a journalist who is working, obviously, totally post-ceasefire as to what ceasefire means to me. So I guess, really, my normality is post-ceasefire. It's my history. It's good history for me. And really, I suppose it's right back at the hub of why I got involved in news and journalism, because I'm someone who's really passionate about this place, about the new stories that are coming from this place, and I believe that new stories should be news. And so that's really why I got involved. And so I'm deeply passionate, really, about the fact that this place is no longer no longer has to have news that is trouble-shaped, and that the ceasefire, for me, what it means is that it allowed new narratives to emerge, and that this place is on an evolving journey, and I'm just really passionate about reporting the news of that journey. Also, I suppose most days in the news, every day there is a story where it is a negotiation between the past and the future, and the working out of what this peace thing is, and I'm just really intrigued by that as well, and just really passionate that that journey continues. And so for me, that is an intriguing world to be involved in. And yes, I remember the frustrations along the way. So I was 13, and I'll just get that out of the way now. You can work that out. So I was 13 in 1994, and you know, I remember the hiccups, the breakdowns in the journey along the way, 1996, 1998, and just all obviously the wrangles over decommissioning and wording, and our more recent wrangling as well is my reporting norm. But aside from all the frustrations, which are the reporting norm, I'm also just really passionate about new narratives, and I do think hope is winning out, and that's why I want to be involved, I guess, in journalism in this place. So to me, I guess, to sum up, ceasefire has allowed our story to change, and that's the story that I want to be involved in reporting. So just a few thoughts, and now we're going to kick off the panel. So basically, we're going to start right back at the start. It is obviously 20 years since the ceasefire, so I'm just going to ask our panel, first of all, just what their memories were of the day, and just the build-up, I guess, to ceasefire. It's easy to call now, but did you see it coming? Barney?
Okay. Well, I suppose I believed it when I heard it. And the ceasefire, as you know, was announced on August 31st, 1994. I'd been put on standby the day before. We actually thought it was going to come on August 30th. I remember that day pacing the BBC newsroom up and down, waiting for the phone to ring. Went home, no call, not knowing why and what had happened. It later emerged that August the 30th had been that continuing wrangle about getting Joe Cahill a visa to go to the States, and that was part of the delay. But I knew that on August 31st, having the statement not having come the day before, that that we were very close to an announcement. Elle, who sang for us, Val was 8 and a bit months pregnant at the time. And she woke up on the morning of August 31st saying to me, "I think the baby's coming." And I remember thinking into myself, "Not today, love." But having enough sense not to say it out loud. But by about 8 o'clock, we knew it was a false alarm. I remember being in a taxi going to the BBC just before 9 o'clock that morning. My phone going when I was in the taxi. And I recognised the voice. I asked the driver, would he stop? And I stepped out of the car onto the footpath. And all he said to me was, same place as Saturday, 11 o'clock, and bring Eamon. Your man.
That's not true. I called him, I told him.
What I've told you is true. I thought about not bringing him, if truth be told. But so I think sometime around 10:30, 20 to 11 that morning, Eamon and I travelled into West Belfast to a coffee shop inside the Kennedy Centre. There was a woman waiting for us. We obviously knew who it was. She had a tiny piece of paper, a com, with the IRA statement on it. She read the first couple of sentences, that from midnight that night there would be a complete cessation of military operations, that all IRA units had been instructed accordingly. And I remember both Eamon and I asking her at the time, would she stop and allow us to newsflash that line? She said, no, my instructions to read the whole statement. And as some people in this room will know, the IRA doesn't say in two sentences what you can say in two chapters. So the statement seemed to go on for forever. But, you know, I can remember then stepping out of the supermarket into the car park. I had a mobile phone with me that was like a car battery. You know, huge, huge bloody thing with something sitting on top of it. Calling the BBC. Eamon was with me. I knew that Charlie in Dublin with Shane Harrison in Dublin were being met as well. And sometime in and around 11 o'clock that morning, the story began to break that the IRA had indeed announced this complete cessation of military operations. The security forces in the build-up believed the IRA would have announced something that was time-limited, either a short number of weeks or a short number of months. And I think they were completely thrown by the fact that it was a complete cessation of military operations. I'll just say one thing to finish. An hour before I went to meet the IRA that morning, I was met by a representative of the Loyalist leadership who gave me the reaction to the IRA statement before the IRA announced it. And basically in their statement, they were calling on Molyneux and Paisley to go to Downing Street to meet Major and to come back and report to the people what deal had been done to secure the IRA ceasefire. Now, it took me a long time to find out how the Loyalists could have known before the statement was announced. But a year later, I was doing a ceasefire documentary for the BBC one year on, and I did an interview with Albert Reynolds, who was Taoiseach at the time. And he started to explain the row over Joe Cahill's visa, why the Yanks were opposed to giving it. He was saying that the Yanks were saying to them, have you read this man's file? You know, and how can we grant this visa not knowing what is coming? And I think Father Alec Reid was then sent to Dublin to give Reynolds an outline of what the IRA statement would be. And Reynolds said that he called three people. He called the President of the United States. He called John Major. And he called the Reverend Roy McGee, a Presbyterian minister who had been in contact with the Loyalists. And McGee told the Loyalists the ceasefire was coming the next morning. And that's how they were then able to prepare their response before the statement emerged.
Okay. Eamon, Charlie, do you want to share your memories?
Charlie, from a certain perspective.
Backroom manoeuvres?
Well, the first thing to be said was, I'm from the South, and I was working for RTE. We were in a different situation because in 1993... Section 31 of the Broadcasting Act was in place. You weren't allowed to interview members of Sinn Féin. And as a journalist at the time, that was extremely difficult. Journalists who worked in RTE, it put us under a lot of pressure. Far back in the 80s, a journalist by the name of Kevin O'Kelly had actually been jailed over a break in Section 31. In 1993, RTE decided that they would have a contact with the IRA. And I think it's extremely important. The peace process was bubbling under the surface. And in the South, a lot of journalists in the North, broadcasting organisations and newspapers in the North and in England, had contact with the IRA. In the South, they didn't. And RTE took a decision in 1993 that we would have contact with the IRA. The man who took the decision was a chap by the name of Joe Mulholland, helped, I have to say, by Tommy Gorman, who was the Western correspondent of RT, or this Northeastern correspondent at the time. And I was the person who was selected to be the contact with the IRA. That contact took place over 12 years, from 1993 to 2005. And in that time, I had four different IRA contacts. I called them Brendan, Patrick, Connor, and Thomas, or Tomas. And the one thing I will say here tonight, and I've said it all the time, that every time I met those people, they never once told me something that was wrong. Anything they told me over the years was always right, always turned out to be correct. And we built up trust in one another over the years. I'll go on and tell you later on about what type of characters these people were. But to build up to the 1994 ceasefire, I met Brendan outside Bewley's restaurant in Westmoreland Street in 1993. I was shit scared because I was a young reporter in Dublin, and the idea of meeting a member of the IRA, and this is the truth, meeting a member of the IRA, and I met him outside Bewley's, and we walked around the town, and he eventually brought me into the winding stairs. And I sat down, and that was the first contact I had with him. 1994, August, the middle of August, there was a lot of discussion about an IRA ceasefire coming. RTE had this mad idea that we would try and meet the IRA contact to see if we could get an interview with the person concerned with the IRA when the statement came out on the 31st of August. So it was around the 25th or 26th of August. I spoke to my Sinn Féin contact, and we drove, like a day like today, up into the Cooley Mountains. I will never, ever forget this. We eventually ended up on the northern side of the border in a small bar, meeting my contact by the name of Brendan. He asked me why I wanted to talk to him, and I said, listen, I want to know if there was going to be an IRA ceasefire, was there a possibility of an interview? God, in my naivety. In my naivety. So he said, okay, I'll listen to you, I'll come back to you. So what was amazing about that night, and in a way it has a resonance for me even today, when we were leaving the bar, he says, do you mind if I have a lift with you? So I said, no. So just think of it, I'm a young fella in my Southern registered car. I'm a leading member of Sinn Féin. I've also got a member of the IRA, and we're going around the back roads of the Cooley Mountains. This was at a time when bombings and shootings were still going on. But the moment that will live with me for the rest of my life, at one point in the journey, it's about 10:30 in the evening, he said to me, stop the car here. I'm getting out now. And he got out and he walked down the road, and the person who was sitting in the front seat with me, the Sinn Féin person, said, hold on. And that person walked down the road, and I saw the two of them embracing one another, and I was struck by it. He disappeared, the person came back, and I said to the person, why were you doing this? And the person looked at me and said, you may not understand, but in a couple of days' time, something very momentous is going to happen for us. And on the 31st of August, at 11 o'clock in the morning, 10:30, outside, close to the Garden of Remembrance. Just remember, that's where I met my contact, close to the Garden of Remembrance. And if somebody had told me that day that almost 18 years later, the Queen would walk into the Garden of Remembrance within a stone's throw from where I got that first IRA statement, I would have told you they were mad. 10:30, got the statement. Andrew Hanlon from 98FM, Shane Harrison from the BBC also got the statement. We also got a tiny cassette, by the way. I don't know if the tiny cassette was given in the North, with an IRA volunteer reading the statement. And it was a very fuzzy statement that was being read. And afterwards I discovered that a hairdryer was being played at the same time that the volunteer was reading the statement, because they didn't want it to know where it was being recorded. So at 11 o'clock, from Barry's Hotel, in a room in Barry's Hotel, I was doing my broadcast onto the airwaves for RTE. And 20 years later, the Titanic Centre, here tonight, the Peace Bridge in Derry, things have moved on. It's fantastic. Eamon.
Who's chairing this one?
Erin Kid Dulcius, but Wylum of Wickens at Dulde, Bas Curro, Hirch, Rich, and Seanoft. Thank you for welcoming me, the members of the committee of Phil and Thubble. I also want to welcome Barney Rowan's family. You're very welcome. Thanks to Elle for singing. And the Reverend John Dunlop and Rosemary, his wife, are both here. And you're very welcome as far as I'm concerned. And I'm sure you'll have an insightful question to put to me and Brian John before the evening's out. But you're very welcome. I'm glad you're here. The Pope is also looking down on me. So we'll see where we go from there. How are you, Francis? You're one of the good guys, I think. You know, in the bad old days of Northern Ireland, when I turned up outside the BBC to meet Brian Rowan, having received a call to go to West Belfast or to go someplace to encounter with a member of the IRA or whatever, the lights turned red in Ormond Avenue. And everybody knew within the BBC there was something happening. Once Brian and I came together, and there usually was something happening.
We're going for tea.
There was a wonderful moment, a humorous moment in West Belfast one time. We went to meet this an IRA spokesperson, and space was a bit scarce in this little cafe. And there was this little old lady, and we were being briefed by this very senior IRA person. And she tried to get into the seat beside him. Do you remember this, Brian?
She got into the seat. Move up there, love.
Move up there, love, she said. I presume this was an IRA commander to whom she was giving some appropriate instructions. But accidents happen to like that. But in terms of my advance notice of the IRA ceasefire, or the impending ceasefire, there were two events in the month of August, three events in the month of August, which were indicative of a potential major development. And I'll start with the first one. And Danny Morrison had been in jail, and Danny's in the front line here, and he'd probably contradict me, but he was in jail and got out to publicise and promote his new book, On the Back of a Swallow. Isn't that right, Danny? Now, Danny, uncharacteristically, dropped a clanger at the press conference, to which I absolutely clung immediately. Because Danny said, this is why an alternative is being examined to armed struggle. Correct, Danny? That parlance?
Now, just getting over that.
Now, I latched onto that immediately, because this was new language to me. Now, I understand Danny was taken upstairs afterwards. Or out the back. I'm not going to say what happened to him. But for me, that was a critical, critical indicative moment. And I majored on it. To my chagrin, the rest of the media ignored it. But that was just the way it was. I ignored Gerry Adams when he said at the City Hall, to that large gathering, the first time the Sinn Féin went to the City Hall, and there was a guy sitting up on the high, perched on a ledge, on the ledge of a window, and he shouted over to Gerry Adams as he was speaking, up the Murph, up the Ra, to which Adams said, I'm going away, you know. I didn't report that. That became a world headline. It went everywhere. But it went over my head. So quite often, we're too close to it. I didn't read into the significance of how that catchphrase of Adams was going to catch on. But Danny made that remark. Now, there was another event in August which was very significant. You had the meeting in Donegal, in Letterkenny. And that meeting was a complete smokescreen. Because the message which emanated from that huge gathering in Donegal was so negative, so negative. Now, somebody told me the morning of that meeting that units right across the country had been briefed by leading Republicans, leading members of the IRA. But nothing that emerged on the day from the Donegal Letterkenny meeting, which was a huge rally, suggested that we were on the cusp of an IRA ceasefire. Ironically, Albert Reynolds and Hume were the two people who struck very contrary notes to the reporting that was emanating from Letterkenny at that point, because obviously Albert and Hume knew what was going on. So that was in the month of August as well. And then there was a third event in August, which was seismic in my life in terms of guiding me where we were going. On the 19th of August, I went to see a leading Republican outside Belfast. And I spent 3 hours with him. And we discussed the whole issue of killing and being a Catholic. I expressed my concerns as a Catholic. I could not be identified with killing. I expressed my antipathy towards killing, my resentful nature towards it. And that same person said to me, he was a very leading IRA man in his day. He said to me, "How do you think I feel?" I have never revealed the identity of that person, but that was such a critical phrase. He said, "How do you think I feel?" And I've thought about that so many, many times. Now, I knew not in a million years was that guy going to tell me the ceasefire is going to happen on such and such a date. But when I stood up to leave, I said to him, "Would I be wise to be out of town in the next 2 weeks to take a break?" It was a very innocent question. Like most of my questions. And he looked me straight in the eye and he said, "Wasn't you, Danny?" "I would not be out of town in the next 2 weeks." Now, Mary Holland was the then correspondent for The Observer. And I told Mary this. And she said, "Evan, you better ring John." That's the way Mary spoke. There was always tension in Mary. I thought there was going to be ceasefire every day when I spoke with Mary. She was a wonderful woman. And she was a wonderful woman. And we should all pay tribute to the professionalism and journalism of the late Mary Holland. Because she really was the lady who put the whole civil rights issue on the map internationally. So anyhow, I called Mary. And Mary said, "You better ring John, Evan." I called John and he crucified me. And then the splash in The Observer on Sunday was IRA ceasefire imminent. And of course, well, the world came down upon me then because everybody wanted to talk to me. How was I so sure of this, etc., etc. That night, on the 19th of August, I walked into the Wellington Park Hotel and there used to be a long bench in front of the reception area. And John Hume was there looking very downcast, crestfallen. And he lifted his head and he said to me, "What do you think, Eamon?" Hume was God to me as a child coming through, as a young man coming through, civil rights leader, everything. And Hume was engaged heavily with Republicans, and we expected so much from Hume. Hume was the man who knew so much, and he's asking me what I thought. Now, the professionalism kicked in at that stage. What was I going to say to him? I had knowledge. The man with whom I'd spent the afternoon had given me a very, very strong steer. And in our business, the one thing you don't do is trade information. So I had my sense of this kicked in immediately. And I thought for a moment and I said, "I'd keep the faith." And I walked on. And he said to me, "Do you think so?" I said, "I'd keep the faith." And little did I know, that night Hume had been mauled in party headquarters. There was a meeting of the party. And at the end of the night, he had three people in the room supporting him, including Mark Durkin and a rural member of the current assembly, and one other person, a lady. He was mauled because he was still talking to Adams. And I'll just sum up here. He said, this is what he said at that meeting. "This is about getting peace. This is a book I wrote if you want to buy it." It's a very good book, very good record of events. Very accurate.
Kendrick's book, no?
The only thing missing from this, I was told, were the expletives of that meeting. But this is what Hume said. "This is about getting peace. This is about ending killing. This is about a chance of ending this misery. And surely we should do everything in our power to help to bring that situation about." At one point he said, "Whatever you think, I'm going to the end of the road. you can get rid of me if I'm wrong. And that was Hume. Hume held the line, and Hume got his result on the 31st of August when the IRA announced that ceasefire. Marin, McGrady, all those guys went against them. And that night, they went back to Alistair MacDonald's home, and Marin cried because he saw the party in bits and in tatters. And really, that was the beginning of the end of the SDLP as a political force. But Hume was determined. Nothing would derail him in terms of that pursuit, sticking with Adams and working towards peace, and he got his rewards. So that's just something of a picture of my experiences of those days. And that morning, going up to meet this person representing the IRA, it was refreshing. It was a well-coutured, coiffed female we met for a change. He said some of those old pudgy, superstitious Republicans, none of whom is in this room. That's another lie. Thank you very much.
Thank you to each of you guys. So in the gap, obviously, between August and 7 weeks on, there was much debate over wording, and it was really the what next. At what stage did each of you maybe start to believe that peace was happening and that this was what you were witnessing?
Well, I think it's worth remembering that on the day of the IRA ceasefire, I mean, I scribbled these names down just before I come out. On the day of the IRA ceasefire, the UVF shot dead Sean McDermott, August 31st, 1994. The next day, the UFF killed John O'Hanlon. So while we had this statement from the IRA, we by no means had peace. And I suppose when, and you know, I can remember this, you know, sitting with Eamon in that wee coffee shop, that woman reading that statement to us, you know, that there would be this complete cessation of military operations. We certainly had that sense of, you know, this was something new. It was something different. I suppose in our own terms, you know, having covered so much of what had gone before, we understood the significance of it, but we didn't really know where it was going. And, you know, I can remember arriving back down into the BBC studio from West Belfast. Barry Cowan was on live, the late Barry Cowan. Willie Ross was in the studio with him. And already he was picking over the wording of the IRA statement. He says it doesn't say permanent. And that word battle then became not just the story of that day, but the days that followed. I think Jim Molyneux described the IRA ceasefire as potentially the most destabilising moment in Northern Ireland's history. So there wasn't that great sense of euphoria. There was a lot of doubt about where it was going. I mean, I found this note in my notes today. This is the note that I took in the supermarket that day in the coffee shop, and I thought I'd written this really sensible, carefully crafted handwritten note that I'd be able to. And I look at it now, and it's a spider scrawl because, you know, after the first two sentences, that's all we wanted to hear. You know, the complete cessation of military operations, all units instructed accordingly, all this stuff about, you know, extending, you know, greetings to, you know, activists and supporters and none of that really, really mattered. But the first significant loyalist response came around September the 8th. Where they set out in six headings what they wanted the government to tell them before they would respond to the IRA statement. And it was all about exploring, had a deal been done? Was Ulster about to be sold out? What about the INLA? What about the other Republican groups? And so we went through about five or 6 weeks. I can remember, you know, Elle was born on September the 22nd. And I can remember getting a phone call at home from a loyalist. He said to me, son, we need to see you. And I said to him, is it really important? And he says, why, what's wrong? I says, you know, my wife's just out of hospital, the baby's home. He says, we'll come to you. I thought, right, okay. I said to him, I'll meet you at the Maypole in Hollywood. Okay.
Bring the champagne.
Meet you at the Maypole in Hollywood. I said, what time would suit? He says, we'll see you between 9:30 and 10:00. And two of them arrived. And I brought them into this wee coffee shop called Claudia's, where all of these blue rinse women from Hollywood had their morning tea, right? And I remember one of them looking at the menu, and he said to the girl behind the counter, would you have anything substantial on, love? And she says, like, what? And he says, like, that lasagna? This is 10 o'clock in the morning. I said to him, would you just sit down, take him with you? And so I bought these three coffees and three scones, went over to the table, one of the guys there, and this will maybe give it away, took his teeth out and put them in a napkin and wrapped them up on the table. So we got round to what the conversation was about, and basically that was kind of like Eamon's August 19th meeting. This was about putting me on notice that that the loyalists were moving towards a ceasefire position. That statement was announced, as you know, on October 13th, 94. The night before, around 8:30, Ivan was meant to be with us here tonight. Ivan Little and myself got a call asking us to come to the Shankill Road, to an office. And we arrived on the Shankill Road. There was a bit of speculation, because Ivan and I were on our way to the Shankill, that the Loyalist ceasefire was about to be announced. And we were kind of thinking, wrong time of night for this to be announced. You know, it's got to be something else. But anyway, when we got to where we were asked to turn up, we were brought into a room, and there were three men there, the UVF leader, the leader of the Red Hand Commando, and a representative of the UDA in our council, representing the combined Loyalist Military Command. And basically this was about getting out the news that the ceasefire was going to be announced the next morning. We said to them, well, you need to give us something. And so they sent next door for Gusty Spence. He was in the office next door. Gusty came in. They said the lads need something here to be able to put the news out that the ceasefire is about to be announced. And Spence said, just leave that with me. And he disappeared from the room for a couple of minutes. And he came back and he handed me this, Ivan and myself, this little, I kept it. This is the 349s he gave me. Says, Belfast, 9:55 p.m. Wednesday, the 12th of October, 1994. The Ulster Democratic and Progressive Unionist parties have called an unprecedented press conference to be held tomorrow morning, 13th of October, 1994, at 9 a.m. in Fernhill House on the old Glencairn Road in West Belfast. And within 60 seconds, the BBC had news flashed out with speculation that the Loyalist ceasefire is imminent. An unprecedented, what's been described as an unprecedented news conference is to be held on the Shankill Road at 9 a.m. in the morning. And you know, the huge difference between the IRA announcement and the Loyalist announcement was the Loyalists wanted to deal with bells and bows. They wanted the media there. They wanted the cameras there. They wanted the news there, newspapers there. And there was one wee strange moment when we arrived at Fernhill House the next morning. The American Bill Flynn was locked in a room. What had happened was, after the Loyalists had met Ivan Little and myself, a couple of them had gone down into the Europa Hotel in Belfast, and Bill Flynn happened to be in the hotel, and one of them produced from his pocket the combined Loyalist Military Command statement. Says they were going to announce this tomorrow morning at Fernhill House at 9 o'clock. They showed it to Jerry Kelly, I think, of UTV at that stage as well, not Jerry Kelly from Sinn Féin in North Belfast. And so when we arrived the next morning, the Loyalists had Bill Flynn in, because the Irish-Americans, as you know, were critical to the IRA announcement in August 94. Bill Flynn, I'm not sure, was terribly welcome at Fernhill House that morning. But that was the huge difference, that while the IRA statement was kind of whispered to us, and we went off then to report it, the Loyalist statement was done with all of the headlines and the news of television, radio, and newspapers. Look at the seven people they had on the top table that day. David Irvine dead, Gusty Spence dead, Jim McDonald dead, John White fled, forced out of the place. Gary McMichael and Davy Adams pushed off the stage. And really the only one of that seven who kind of has survived within the Loyalist world is Plum Smith, who chaired that news conference that day. And I think the important learning of what I've just said there is we were dealing with a huge moment in history. And we dealt with it at the time as news. You know, and I have gone back to speak to people from that 1994 period. And their memory's not good. They get dates wrong. They get facts wrong. And I think there is a need to get the living memory of that period and the period before it recorded as soon as possible and before it's too late, because it will be the generation beyond us who I think will try to make sense of 1994 and what came before 1994 and what has happened since. Mm-hmm.
Few reflections. Being down in the south, one is far away from what's happening in Belfast. There wasn't a very fast telegraph. In fact, on many occasions, on one particular occasion, I was in West Cork around this time of the year when I got a phone call from my IRA contact. I think it was Patrick, who I've always described. He was my second contact. I've always described Patrick as he looked like a school teacher. I never envisaged him to be, you know, a member of the IRA or on the IRA Army Council. But Patrick turned out to be a very interesting person, because unlike Brendan, Patrick would occasionally ask you, what do you think? But I just want to say one thing. Down in the south, we were away from what was happening up here, but the one person, and I'm not to be added into any of the names, my person I dealt with in Sinn Féin all the time is still a remarkable person today. I call her the Ban Rua, mm-hmm. Rita O'Hare. Throughout all my period as a reporter in the South, I had lots of dealings with Rita O'Hare. And she is an absolutely remarkable, remarkable, remarkable person. And, you know, in general, when she wasn't certain what was happening within, what was going on, I would say to her, what do you think? She said, I don't know, but we should do this, look, whatever. And I built up a trust with her, like I built up trust with my Brendan, Patrick, Connor and Tomás. And over the years, as I said at the outset, I built up something that I knew that we were often described as a postman. People down the set would accuse me of just being a postman for the IRA, because all you were getting on occasions was a statement. And in one sense, you were parroting it out. But it was clearly important that what was going on, the line of communication. As I say, the removal of Section 31 in January 1994, it was clear. It was all part of the jigsaw that the peace process was beginning to work, that it was happening underneath the surface. Things were moving on. And there were dark periods. There were black periods during the peace process, because I was... When the ceasefire broke down in 1996 during the Canary Wharf bombing, for me personally, it was the lowest point of my contact with the IRA, because on that occasion, I was the only person to be given the IRA statement. Occasionally, they went to a whole lot of people. On different occasions, on two occasions, they went to me and no one else. And that was one of them. And on the Friday, when that ceasefire broke down, I was not in the right place. I should have been in the RTE newsroom. I'd gone home with the cold. And unfortunately, by the time that I got the phone call, it was from Brendan, it was only minutes before the bomb went off in Canary Wharf. What had happened was the IRA statement was to be given to me, put out an RTE. The IRA had issued another statement. I think somebody said it was to the Time.
I think it was the Time magazine, or whoever
in London. And people weren't joining the dots. And I felt really, really awful about it, because I believe if I had got the statement and put it out at 6 o'clock, there would have been an hour of a difference. Now, afterwards, I was told by people that you were not to blame. But myself and Ed Mulhall, who was the boss of news, the head of news at the time, we always felt that in a way we had let people down, because But just it was the only time in my life I'd gone home. I'd never been a day sick in RT in my life, and yet I went home that afternoon with a cold, and I wasn't in the right place at the right time to take that statement. But things moved on. But, you know, we were called, Dan said, postman for the IRA, but I never believed that. I believe it was part of the communication, part of the things happening. Yet, occasionally, we were just issuing, taking statements, putting them out. And there was a rivalry, by the way. There's no doubt about it. We wanted to try and beat Downtown or beat the BBC. Eamon Mali
there
would
no
be on.
No harm in trying.
No, exactly. And it was very difficult. But to be honest, the media, you know, the media, you want to, that's part of the story. Try to, you know, be ahead of the posse, even on something when everybody's getting it at the same time. And of course, it was always difficult to beat, in particular, Eamon Mali.
I want to protest. I've been misrepresented already on Twitter. The cartoon is cruel to some people. Brian Spencer here is a celebrated cartoonist at the back of the room here, and he's betrayed the panelists here. You look very well, Judith. Charlie, you're not too bad. I don't look too bad myself. Yeah. Brian Rowan has less hair than he had when he came in. Jim Gibney was inviting us to give you some flavour of how we operated in this dark world. And it was a bit of a dark world, because we were liable to some offence had we been caught in possession of an IRA statement. We could have been accused of being party to or an accessory to or whatever. Charlie used a phrase there which really scared me, about knowing about something before it happened. It was always a great... It was always very, very careful not to know about something before it happened. We had a correspondent, a rural correspondent, who operated from the south of Northern Ireland. In fact, he operated the other side of the border. But he was very familiar with the workings of South Armagh. That's another thing, Charlie. You said that you were afraid. We were never afraid in South Armagh. but this guy, we got word that there had been a bomb in South Armagh. Near across McGlen, and this guy came on and told us about that bomb. And then there was another phone call to our newsroom to tell us that there'd been a bomb in Fork Hill. So the news editor phoned the guy, the correspondent in the area, and he said, "Do you know anything about a second bomb at Fork Hill?" He says, "Has that one gone off?" That was a very dangerous situation for any journalist to find oneself. Now, do you know how I addressed that? This is a factual situation. When we would meet with a member of the IRA, sometimes we would not be given a statement. Sometimes we'd be asked to write down a statement, and the holder of the statement would leave with the statement in his or her pocket. But any time, generally speaking, I was afforded or access to a statement, once I got back to the car or got to the back of the room or whatever in the building in which I found myself and got my report done, do you know what I did with the statement? I put it in my mouth and I masticated it and I chewed it up into tiny little pieces, and when I reached the first first patch of earth, I put my heel in the ground, dropped it down, and tramped on it. So there are lots of bits of history.
I followed him and dug them out of the ground.
So we were liable to potential sedition, which I think was the charge, if we'd been party to having in our possession an IRA statement. Because Charlie spoke about the guys who didn't ever mislead him. Most of the people who would be entrusted with that sort of information on behalf of the IRA Army Council, they would be smart guys. They would be very well informed, very, very adult in how they handled the statement. And there was no point in asking questions. Can you expand on this? Can you expand on the other? There was no expanding. That's what you got. That's, you had to live with that. But that's what I used to do with the statements. All those bits of history which I buried along the
the Lisburn Road. There is no muck on the Lisburn Road.
There's another very. I'll just tell you another anecdote. This gives you an insight into how the sort of world in which we lived. We got a call to go to a pub a little south of here in West Belfast. And we went to that pub, and a guy met us, and he said, "We're traveling." And we came out of the pub, we got into the back of this car. Brian was handed a pair of dark glasses.
Was handed two pieces of tape first.
And I was handed it, and then we were given this tape. We were driven to where, I don't know. I didn't know where it was when I was in Antrim Hills either with Paisley, so I mean, so it was no different. I at least had a pre-run, having done it with Paisley up the mountain in Antrim. But anyway, when we got out of the car, then we were steered and navigated, God knows where, down steps, along a corridor, into a house, and we were given a statement. I think somebody's still actually dictating it. It was the longest statement I've ever seen from the IRA.
But
Brian made a very good note. Brian made a very good note of it. I couldn't keep up with it. I didn't have shorthand, so I had to depend totally on Brian to fill me in with contents of the statement afterwards. This just gives you an insight into how we operated in that dark world. And it was a dark world. There was always a danger that we could have been arrested, caught in the presence of somebody within the IRA. And I have to say, despite what people think, I have no sense whatsoever that I was ever tracked, I was ever followed, or I have no evidence my phone was ever tapped throughout the Troubles. I have no evidence of that. Maybe they were at it every day, but they didn't actually move against me, thank God.
Can I just say one thing? In RTE, every time I got an IRA statement, the special branch arrived at the front entrance. I'm not joking you, they arrived at the front entrance of RTE, and there would be a phone call to the director of news to talk to me, and I'd be sent down to meet the detectives, and they'd ask me, you know, where did you get the statement? I said, well, look, you know, but they would go through that format all the time. I mean, in RTE, down in the south, every time I was on air with an IRA statement, they always came to the station to ask to see me, and I'd go down to the reception of Montrose, and the two guys would say, they knew I wasn't trying, you know, and they knew they were going through pro forma, and I'd say, I can't tell you, and say, fine, thank you very much, and they'd go off. But Eamon is right, you know, as I said, we were doing things that they didn't particularly like, and that in some cases that other media outlets did not like either. There's absolutely no doubt that other media outlets did not like it for various reasons, as you can imagine.
I just wanted to pick up on something. The night that Charlie wasn't in RTE and and the IRA statement was issued.
That's not fair enough. Come on, Brian. Give him a break. He's a visitor here.
Hang on.
He's a tourist.
Yeah. So I can remember sitting, the head of news at the BBC at that stage was a man called Tony Maddox. And I was sitting in his office that Friday at tea time. And he was telling me how the BBC was going to relaunch its news that Monday. That we were in a new place, we were in a new time, and that things were going to be different. And Maddox's door opened and Stephen Grimason, who was then the political editor, popped his head in the door. He says, "Barney, RTE want to have a word with you. There's a statement from the IRA that the ceasefire is about to be ended." And I looked at Maddox, you know, who was planning his new all singing, all dancing, new Northern Ireland news for Monday. And I went out and I spoke to RTE, and they were asking Charlie, did we have the statement? And we hadn't. And there was this sort of conversation that went on for the best part of an hour about what to do and what not to do. I rang somebody who I knew would know, and they answered the phone and told me he wasn't in. So I said, "Are you sure that's not you?" And he says, "No, I'm not mentioning the name. He's not in." And I then rang somebody in Belfast who put the phone down on me. And I suppose it was at that stage that I began to realise that there was something to this. There's something in my memory, Charlie, about, and I think it was Time magazine, got the call, which was the actual bomb warning for Canary Wharf. Yeah. And that's when people then began to realise that we were we were in a serious situation. I think that story that Eamon told about that day the IRA took us away was probably why in 1994 we understood the significance of what was being announced. The night before, the IRA took us away, they'd killed three of their own people. Mm-hmm. Dignam, Stars and Burns left their bodies in South Armagh. I found two of the bodies. Man lying almost naked across a grass bank in the middle of the road. Another man, and there was a black bin bag over the top of him, and a milk crate had been put on top of the bin bag, lying on the side of the road. And we didn't find the third body. And I was reporting that those killings for the BBC. And it was the next morning then that we got this call to turn up somewhere at 11 o'clock. And we were actually met by two young men, Eamon, because one of them took each of us by the arm, gave us the tape, the glasses, went to a house where were two men in balaclavas, read us a very, very long IRA statement, which was detailing the killing of Dignam, Stars and Burns. A young woman's body had been found at that stage, Margaret Perry, who'd been strangled, I think, with a blang cord and buried in a grave, I think in Sligo, from memory. So we then put the tape back in our eyes, the glasses back in our eyes, and we were dropped off by the two young men where we were picked up. And I went back to the BBC and there was a bit of an earthquake when I explained to them this set of circumstances. In fact, they offered me some counselling, and I declined their offer because at that stage, I thought this indicates some sign of weakness, but I think that far into things, they were beginning to realise what they were asking and what they were sending people out to do, and I think of the people who covered the '70s, you know, covered Bloody Friday, Bloody Sunday, and all of that. What they went through, what they witnessed, what they saw. So, I think when that woman read that statement to us in 1994, announcing the complete cessation of military operations, that all units had been stood down, I think we understood the significance of where that might take us. And I think, you know, 20 years after the event, I think like everybody else who's out there, we are in a better position where we can better describe what our role was, where we failed, how we reported conflict, who we talked to, who we didn't talk to. Did we take sides? Did we talk to one side and not others? And I think that's part of the journalistic responsibility now, that a couple of us, the small number of us who were in those very privileged positions where we were able to talk to the IRA, the loyalists, the branch, the spooks, the army, the political people around that maybe 20 years beyond the event, we're now in a better position to talk about processes, share information that we might have. I think of the statements that I took over the years, probably a line or two of them. I think I transcribed that statement that Eamon was talking about. It took me 14 pages to transcribe it. I'd say four lines got on the BBC that afternoon. You know, the IRA has issued a statement this afternoon, you know, following the discovery of three bodies in South Armagh last night. So I think we've got a responsibility in the here and now to share with people some of our experiences, some of the information, and also to share with journalists in other conflict zones what happened here, how we got to this point, what we think we got right, what we think we got wrong. And there is certainly, I know that people use this term rewriting history or revising history. I think there is a need to correct and update the narrative, you know, and I think there are some of us who could help fill in missing gaps.
You were so close to, each of you have shared really personally about how you were so invested in it. Do you ever have a moment where you were just, I'm too close? Well, probably some of the stories you've already shared, but how difficult was it to report then impartially?
Could I just say something? I hated that killing. I hated that violence from where it emanated. I was born into a civil rights basket. I was in the first major civil rights march in Uri. So that's the environment out of I emerged, from which I emerged. I don't think there was anything glorious about what we did to each other. What we did to each other, I think, was horrendous. Horrendous collectively in this place. Awful, awful. What we did to each other. That was history. That was then. What we must do is guard against a repetition of that. That's the big challenge to us all. We must guard against a repetition, against what went before. Even though I hated the application of violence at every level, it didn't deter me from trying to understand those who perpetrated and applied violence. That's why I went into the Mays prison, or Longkesh, some people speak of it as Longkesh. That's why I went into Longkesh. I sought a visit to Longkesh, Mays prison, to visit a Republican and a UVF prisoner in 1979. And I met a UVF man called Dowds from Portadown. And you know the horrors that were perpetrated in that area. The Dowds family, the Reevey brothers, Kingsmill further up the road, all of those horrors, awful, awful killings. So Ernie Dowds was the man I met from the UVF. They were damaging themselves at that time. Republicans were protesting. And I wanted to find out what is making these people behave the way they were behaving. Now, I had covered the killing of Earl Mountbatten and Narrowwater in the same day. I drove to Mullaghmore for the killing of Mountbatten and his family, an old man in a boat, and drove back to Narrowwater that evening to cover one of the worst IRA atrocities or attacks in the history of the Troubles. And when I went into the jail, I met a man of whom I knew nothing. I had never heard his name before. A guy called Ribert O'Shaughnessy. His name didn't mean anything to me. The minute I walked in to the visitor's area, this guy who came forward, who turned out to be Bobby Sands, was not the Bobby Sands you see on the posters, with the free-flowing hair, the full face, the joyous, happy guy. He was a very emaciated, sick man with long, greasy hair. He reminded me of some cornered animal in his gestures, every move. He had been in isolation, had been on the boards, I think was the technical term, Danny, for quite a while. And he was now coming out to talk with me. He spoke fluent Irish. I mean, the most fluent Irish I have ever heard for a non-graduate. The jail talk, as they talk about Irish, those who learn Irish in the jail, normally it's not great. You learn the Gaeltacht Irish is usually better. But Bobby Sands spoke unbelievably fluently, even on technical terms. He didn't speak English to me at all for a full hour during that visit. So even though I felt such an antipathy towards that violence, I had always that inquisitive dimension to my mind. And that's why I don't believe in glorifying our past. I'm not proud of our past collectively. We were there for the UVF ceasefire. We met Johnny Adair on the Shankill Road. I think, Brian, you might have been there with me. And if I'm wrong about this, when Johnny Adair said, "You've heard of Mad Dog, now meet Mad Pup," isn't that what he said?
No, I wasn't there for that meeting, I have to say. Really.
But you see, the psychology of sometimes would alarm you. But I wouldn't want anyone to think here that just because we were party to these situations that... it was a glorious existence. It wasn't a glorious existence because the violence being visited upon UDR men, RUC officers, correspondingly, that same violence was being visited on the families of IRA people. And that's where this whole thing breaks down when it comes to dealing, I think, with the past and with the victims, because essentially, who among us didn't know somebody who was killed? This whole community is a victim community. We were all victims. And I think Mary McAleese got it right when she said, in a very, very profound but simple statement, if you come from here, there's a sediment of sectarianism in us all.